It so happened that on this day, an EMV, belonging to a Protectorate Air Quality Control Manager, was passing low above, and the wife of the manager, traveling alone to the ARC's company residential store, ordered the EMV down, had her android servant retrieve me, and what was left of my Kantos, and then personally drove me to the company hospital. Normally, the members of the bonded workforce received medical aid, if any, at the walk-in bioclinic, but the hospital did not want to refuse the wife of a manager, so I was admitted, still unconscious, and watched over by a human doctor and the manager's wife while I recovered in a healing tank. All right, to make a banal long story into a banal short story, I'll cut to the uplink. Helenda, that was the manager's wife, read my manuscript while I was floating in renewal nutrient. She liked it. On the same day I was being decanted in the company hospital, Helenda farcast to Renaissance, where she showed my Kantos to her sister Felia, who had a friend whose lover knew an editor at Transline Publishing. When I awoke the next day, my broken ribs had been set, my shattered cheekbone had been healed, my bruises were gone, and I'd received 5 new teeth, a new cornea for my left eye, and a contract with Transline. My book came out 5 weeks later. A week after that, Helenda divorced her manager and married me. It was her 7th marriage, my first. We honeymooned on the concourse and, when we returned a month later, my book had sold more than 1 billion copies, the first book of verse to hit the bestseller lists in 4 centuries. And I was a millionaire many times over. Tarenna Wingreen Fief was my first editor at Transline. It was her idea to title the book The Dying Earth. A records search showed a novel by that name 500 years earlier, but the copyright had lapsed and the book was out of print. It was her idea to publish just the sections of the Kantos which dealt with the nostalgic final days of old Earth. And it was her idea to remove the sections which she thought would bore the readers, the philosophical passages, the descriptions of my mother, the sections which paid homage to earlier poets, the places where I played with experimental verse, the more personal passages. Everything, in fact, except the descriptions of the idyllic final days, which, emptied of all heavier freight, came across as sentimental and insipid. 4 months after publication, The Dying Earth had sold 2.5 billion hard facts copies. An abridged and digitalized version was available on the C-Thing datasphere, and it had been optioned for the Hollies. Tarenna pointed out that the timing had been perfect, that the original trauma shock of the death of old Earth had meant a century of denial, almost as if Earth had never existed, followed by a period of revived interest culminating in the old Earth nostalgia cults, which could now be found on every world in the web. A book, even a book of verse, dealing with the final days, had struck at precisely the right moment. For me, the first few months of life as a celebrity in the hegemony were far more disorienting than my earlier transition from spoiled son of old Earth to enslaved stroke victim on Heaven's Gate. During those first months, I did book and fax signing on more than 100 worlds. I appeared on the All Net Now show with Marmon Hamlet. I met CEO Sinister Perot and All Things speaker Drury Fine, as well as a score of senators. I spoke to the Interplanetary Society of Penwomen and to the Lussis Writers Union. I was given honorary degrees at the University of New Earth and at Cambridge, too. I was feted, interviewed, imaged, reviewed favorably, bioed unauthorized, lionized, serialized, and swindled. It was a busy time. Notes for a sketch of life in the hegemony. My home has 38 rooms on 36 worlds. No doors. The arched entrances are Farcaster portals. A few opaqued with privacy curtains. Most open to observation and entry. Each room has windows everywhere, and at least two walls with portals. From the grand dining hall on Renaissance Vector, I can see the bronze skies and the verdigris towers of Keep Enable in the valley below my volcanic peak. And by turning my head, I can look through the Farcaster portal and across the expanse of white carpet in the formal living area to see the Edgar Allan Sea crash against the spires of Point Prospero on Nevermore. My library looks out on the glaciers and green skies of Nordholm, while a walk of 10 paces allows me to descend a short stairway to my tower study, a comfortable, open room encircled by polarized glass, which offers a 360-degree view of the highest peaks of the Kushpat Karakoram, a mountain range 2,000 kilometers from the nearest settlement in the easternmost reaches of the Jamnu Republic on Deneb Dry. The huge sleeping room Helenda and I share rocks gently in the boughs of a 300-meter world tree on the Templar world of God's Grove, and connects to a solarium which sits alone on the arid salt flats of Hebron. Not all of our views are of wilderness. The media room opens to a skimmer pad on the 138th floor of a Tau Ceti Center arc tower, and our patio lies on a terrace overlooking the market in the old section of bustling New Jerusalem. The architect, a student of the legendary Milan de Havre, has incorporated several small jokes into the house's design. The steps go down to the tower room, of course, but equally droll is the exit from the area which leads to the exercise room on the lowest level of Lussus's deepest hive. Or perhaps the guest bathroom, which consists of toilet, bidet, sink, and shower stall on an open, wall-less raft afloat on the violet sea world of Mare Infinitus. At first, the shifts in gravity from room to room were disturbing, but I soon adapted, subconsciously bracing myself for the drag of Lussus and Hebron and Sol Draconi Septim, unconsciously anticipating the less than one standard G freedom of the majority of the rooms. In the 10 standard months Helenda and I are together, we spend little time in our home, preferring instead to move with friends among the resorts and vacation arcologies and night spots of the world web. Our friends are the former Farcaster set, now calling themselves the Caribou Herd, after an extinct Old Earth migratory mammal. This herd consists of other writers, a few successful visual artists, concourse intellectuals, all-thing media representatives, a few radical arnists and cosmetic gene splicers, web aristocrats, wealthy Farcaster freaks and flashback addicts, a few Holly and stage directors, scattering of actors and performance artists, several mafia dons gone straight, and a revolving list of recent celebrities, myself included. Everyone drinks, uses stims and auto implants, takes the wire and can afford the best drugs. The drug of choice is flashback. It is definitely an upper-class vice. One needs the full range of expensive implants to fully experience it. Helenda has seen to it that I have been so fitted. Biomonitors, sensory extenders, an internal comm log, neural shunts, kickers, metacortex processors, blood chips, RNA tapeworms. My mother wouldn't have recognized my insides. I try flashback twice. The first time is a glide. I target my 9th birthday party and hit it with the first salvo. It is all there. The servants singing on the north lawn at daybreak. Don Balthazar grudgingly canceling classes so I can spend the day with Amalfi in my EMV. Streaking across the gray dunes of the Amazon basin in gay abandon. The torchlight procession that evening, as representatives of the other old families arrive at dusk, their brightly wrapped presents gleaming under the moon, and the 10,000 lights. I rise from 9 hours in flashback with a smile on my face. The second trip almost kills me. I am 4 and crying, seeking my mother through endless rooms, smelling of dust and old furniture. Android servants seek to console me, but I shake off their hands, running down hallways soiled with shadows and the soot of too many generations. Breaking the first rule I ever learned, I throw open the doors to Mother's sewing room, her sanctum sanctorum, to which she retires for 3 hours every afternoon, and from which she emerges with her soft smile, the hem of her pale dress whispering across the carpet, like an echo of a ghost's sigh. Mother is sitting there, in the shadows. I am 4, and my finger has been hurt, and I rush to her, throwing myself into her arms. She does not respond. One of her elegant arms remains reclined along the back of the chaise lounge, the other remains limp on the cushion. I pull back, shocked by her cool plasticity. I tug open the heavy velvet drapes without rising from her lap. Mother's eyes are white, rolled back in her head. Her lips are slightly open. Drool moistens the corners of her mouth and glints on her perfect chin. From the gold threads of her hair, done up in the grande dame style she favors, I see the cold steel gleam of the stim wire and the duller sheen of the skull socket she has plugged it into. The patch of bone on either side is very white. On the table, near her left hand, lies the empty flashback syringe. The servants arrive and pull me away. Mother never blinks. I am pulled, screaming from the room. I wake, screaming.